Love that song. Just the reality confronts you with the reality and forces you to acknowledge the fact that Jesus is coming soon. And for the believer, for the child of God who's trusted in Jesus, that is a very good thing and a very desirable thing. Because when he comes, he will come and make all things new. In the book of Revelation, he tells John, that he would be the one that wipes away every tear. There'll be no more death, for death would have been swallowed up with the devil. There'll be no more enemies to fight. There'll be no more sin. There'll be no heartache. There'll be no more struggle. When Jesus comes, when I grew up, they say every day will be Sunday, and the Sabbath would have no end. We'd spend eternity in worship and in praise and adoration and awe of our God. It says even there won't even need to be the sun when that day comes, because the glory of the Lord will shine so bright and he will be our light. So we have something to look forward to. And this is, it's encouraging, because that means it doesn't matter where your station is in life right now. You have something to look. You have something way better. Even the best of this life can't even compare to the life that is to come. So whether you're rich, that's still just a mini piece of what it will be like when Jesus comes back. And if you're poor, if you're struggling, it's okay, because the life that is to come is so much better, and it will be so worth it when you look back, because you've trusted Jesus with your life. Now, human beings are capable of doing some amazing things. We are pretty gifted people. God created us in his image and his likeness, so we are creative, and there are things that we do really well, for instance, and they probably don't want to acknowledge them, like most of them aren't even here right now. But if you've noticed, this morning when you walked up into the church, you actually walked up on something that was sturdy and looks very nice. So a few of the men came yesterday and gave their time to rebuild the ramps outside of our church so that we would all be safe. And it looks amazing. It looks like professionals did it, because, well, some of them are professionals. It's just a testimony. It was like, when we put our minds together and when we want to do stuff, we can make things happen. And so we certainly thank God for the men in our church who dedicated their Saturday, gave up their time to do that. You know what else we're really good at as human beings? And this is like universal. So whether you're black, white, from Ukraine or the United States, what we're really good as human beings is blame shifting. That was like an extreme, like, so celebrate them building the ramp. Yeah, let's get real. That was just set up. Let's talk real for a moment. We're really good at blame shifting. And if you don't believe this is probably a bad example, and I'm not talking about any of your kids with this example that I want to see. If you want to see the best and worst of creation, look at children. Like, you see, like, the best of the innocence and just complete trust and complete abandonment and just complete freedom, and, you know, they don't have to worry about, like, the stuff that adults have to worry about. So there's just complete freedom to just run around and just be a kid and just play in the dirt and do that stuff. Don't have to worry about bills and stuff like that. But you can also see the worst in kids. When I was a kid, I remember getting in trouble, and the moment I got in trouble, my first response would be, but so-and-so did this. So-and-so made me do it. It wasn't me, but he pushed me. So the blame shift. I was responsible. I did something wrong, but my first response was to blame someone else. And as you get older, you start to get smarter about it. You start to say, "Oh, the devil made me do it. That old devil caught me." that devil, he tempted me, he drugged me into it. And some of us, and a lot of us, whether we say it out loud or not, we even blame God for the mistakes that we make. We will say something like this: well, God made me this way. If God didn't want me to do this, if God didn't want me to be this way, if he didn't want me to do these things, then why would he put me in this family? Why would he put me in this situation? Why would he allow me to struggle? Why would he bring this person into my life? Why would he give me that job? God, it's your fault that I've fallen into this. It's your fault that I became addicted. It's your fault that I've made all these mistakes. It's your fault you've made me this way. And so I'm not going to take responsibility for it. I'm going to blame it on you. You're the one that's in control. You could have made me perfect. But you didn't, and this is the reason why I am the way I am. So, God, it's on you. And as human beings, we are amazingly good at blame shifting. We're amazingly good at passing the buck. And it goes all the way back to the Garden of Eden. And it goes all the way back to our first parents when they sinned and when they stepped outside of the boundaries God set. The first thing Adam and Eve did was to cast blame. God comes to them in the garden. He tells them, you can eat of any tree except the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And they said, okay, cool. Until they're tempted and enticed by the serpent, and they did eat of the fruit of the tree. And God comes to them and said, what was the deal? I thought we had an agreement. You can eat of everything except that tree. And he tells Adam, he said, Adam, dude, what happened? That woman you gave me, she listened to the serpent, she gave it to me, and I did eat. Okay, let's go down the line. Eve, what happened? That serpent, he did deceive me, and I did eat. And all throughout history, that's been the story of humanity. We make mistakes, and we look everywhere else to pass blame. In the book of James, the brother of Jesus, he speaks to this very thing. And he speaks because it's so prevalent. It's an issue that all of us struggle. If you're human, if you're breathing, if you bleed red blood, you struggle with this. And James, in this letter to Jews and this letter to Christian, he sets out to reconfigure the way we think about life. And this letter is about what it means to live, to be whole. What does it mean to live in wholeness before God? And he says all of it starts with faith. And Tom preached last week that our faith is the most important thing about us. So all of life is lived in faith or not lived in faith. There's only two options in life. Even last week we talked about how being double-minded, trying to ride the fence and trying to trust God, but hedge your bets in the world and trying to pursue both the eternal and the temporary, it blocks you from receiving God. And God hates double-minded people. So all of life is either live trusting God by faith or trusting something else. And James says this affects every single part of our lives, especially when we go through trials. And every human being on this earth goes through some sort of trial. And what you can tell a lot about what you really believe, we can tell about how you handle and how you respond to trials. We can tell what's going on the inside by how you act on the outside. And so last week we talked about when bad things happen, it reveals whether or not we are really trusting God. Because a lot of people say they trust God, but when bad things happen, do you really trust God? And your actions, not your lips, not your words, tell the truth about you. And just as all of us face trials of different kinds, you know what all of us face? The other thing? We all face temptation. And James continues on this in this letter. He continues on this teaching about what it means to be whole and what it means to allow your faith to penetrate and infiltrate area of your lives, including suffering through trials, and especially responding to when you're confronted with temptation and your own sin. So if you have your Bible, I invite you to open to James chapter 1, starting at verse 13. As he concludes in verse 12, he says, "Blessed is the man who perseveres under trial, because when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life that God has promised to those who love him." Then he continues in verse 13, where we'll start today. It says, "And when tempted, no one should say, 'God is tempting me.' For God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. But each one, every single person, is tempted when, by his or her own evil desire, he is dragged away and enticed. Then, after desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is full grown, gives birth to death. Don't be deceived, my dear brothers. Every good and perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of the heavenly lights, who does not change like shifting shadows. He chose to give us birth through the word of truth, that we might be a kind of first fruit of all he created." James says, when you face trials, it reveals whether or not you trust God. And he says also, when you face temptation and when you're confronted with your sin, how you respond reveals something about your faith as well. How you respond to temptation and how you respond to the reality of sin in your life when you fall in temptation says a lot about your faith. And our central truth this morning, as we talk about this, is this. Your first fill in the blank. Sin fundamentally is rooted in a lack of faith in the goodness of God. At its core, sin is fundamentally rooted in a lack of faith in the goodness of God. Every single time you sin, what you're saying to God is that I don't trust that you, what you have given me, what you have set up for me, what you have laid out for me is not good enough, and I'm going to trust, put my trust in something else. Every single time, at the root of sin in our hearts is this idea that God is withholding something from me. God is not that good, because if he was that good, then he'd give me that thing that I really, really want that would make me feel good. And because he does not, he's not good, and so I'm going to go in another direction. And sin, for every single person, no matter how that sin comes out in your life, no matter how it's demonstrated, that's what it is. I don't trust that God is good, so I'm looking to something else. Therefore, as we look at this passage, James brings out something crucial and important that we have to consider when we're, not if we're faced with temptation, but when we're faced with temptation. And here it is, your next fill in the blank. Therefore, every temptation is an invitation to distrust God. Every temptation is an invitation to distrust God. When we are confronted with temptation, something or someone is inviting us to distrust God. It gives us an opportunity to either declare our faith in God, or it gives us an opportunity to say, God, I don't believe you're that good, so I'm going to follow my own way. I'm going to find something else. I'm going to look to something else and look to someone else. This section can be linked to the previous section where it talks about trials, or it can be viewed as a standalone when dealing with temptation. In any event, the truth of the matter is, just as all men and women, especially those who belong to God, experience trials, those same people are prone to experiencing and having to deal with temptation and sin. And here's the distinction that James wants to make, that while trials are from the outside, the trials are brought on by external forces, temptation comes from the inside. That's what he says in verses 13 through 15. He says, while trials are things that are happening to you from the outside, that you're experiencing circumstances, life is happening to you from the outside, temptation is brought about because of what's going on the inside. And because it starts from what's inside, you can't blame everything else on the outside, because it comes from within. Every trial, every external difficulty, even those things, carries with it a temptation. This is this inner enticement to sin, to go against God's command, to distrust God, to diminish his goodness, and to walk outside of his established relational boundaries. What James does in this section, he continues to build on how what's going on the inside of us plays itself out on the outside. How then we view and handle temptation reveals a lot about our character, and more importantly, our faith. So James provides us with wisdom then. How do we respond? How do we handle temptation and the reality of when we give into temptation? It's twofold. How do we handle temptation when it comes, and how do we respond when we give into temptation? Number one, when temptation happens, James says, take responsibility for your role in it. You take responsibility. Instead of what's natural to us is to look and point out everything else and everybody else that was wrong, that led me to be wrong, James says, own it. Own your role in it. He says when in verse 13, when tempted, no one should say, God is tempting me. For God can't even be tempted by evil. He's good. He's perfectly holy and righteous. Therefore, he would never do anything that would go against that, or that would undermine his holiness or goodness or righteousness. For God cannot be tempted, nor, because of who he is, as holy, righteous, and pure and perfect, he does not tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when? By his own evil desire. You know who causes temptation in your life? You. Other things may help fan that flame, but that the root of temptation is your own evil desire. Temptation is only temptation because you desire it. That's why for some people, you put a bottle in front of them and they're like, I'm good. Because that's not something that they desire anyway. But for others, you put a bottle in front of them, and it could turn their whole world upside down with one sip. Because it's a desire to them that they've given in, that they've fallen into, and it's an addiction for them that draws them and pulls them away and sends them spiraling down this road that they don't want to go down. But because the desire is there, it's a temptation for them. That's why we shouldn't look down on people struggling with temptation, or the temptation that we don't, that's not a struggle with us. And we're good at that. That when we're good at pointing out other people's struggles. We're good at bad mouthing people when they give in to certain sins that don't really affect. Why would you do that? Why is that a thing for you? When we should be asking and looking at our own lives and confronting our own taking responsibility for our own evil desires that are going on in each and every one of our hearts. James says, listen, you want to fight, you want to overcome, you want to walk in freedom from temptation and sin, or you want to overcome temptation when it's presented from you. First of all, you need to take responsibility and own it. Confront it head on. The only reason why this is temptation for me is because I want it, and I need to deal with that. I need to deal with the fact that I want this thing that God does not want for me. I need to be honest with myself that there are some things in my life that are pulling me away from God because I want them to. And I need God's help to overcome that. But if I don't take responsibility, if I blame everybody else, then I get no help because I don't think I need any help. And what Tom preached last week is that he says, if anyone needs wisdom, if anyone needs help, ask God, and what? He'll give it to you generously. The reason why we don't overcome temptation on a regular basis or more often is because we don't think we need help in fighting it. And then we find ourselves at rock bottom wondering how we got there. And then, because we're so prideful, we look at everything else and everybody else. Well, you made me do it. You did this. He did this to me. She did this to me. He didn't do this. And so because they didn't do this, I fell into it. It's their fault. When James says, no, honey, child, brother, sister, friend, it's not everybody else that's the problem. The problem is with you. And if you want to be whole, if you want to experience the blessing and joy of being a child of God, then you have to own up to your mess. You have to own up to the darkness that still resides in your heart. We've been delivered from the dominion of sin so much so that we don't have to sin anymore, because before God, we didn't have a choice but to sin because that's all we knew. But now, because of Christ and what he's done, and we've been regenerated and we've been given a new nature, we've been delivered from the power of sin so that we can choose and we can align ourselves and give our allegiance to someone else, but we're still being delivered from the presence of sin. And because that's our reality, we have to be all the more vigilant of taking ownership and identifying what's going on in our hearts. James says, look at your own heart when you're confronted with temptation. And it's being honest with yourself. That's the first step of being able to conquer, overcome, and walk in the victory that God has given you. My desire as your pastor, my desire for my own life is that I walk in the victory that God has given me in Christ. But I cannot do that if I never look inward. And he says, we know it's wrong when you blame everyone, but it's doubly wrong to blame God. Because when you blame God, you blaspheme him. You go against his very name. You cut him down in such a way that if that's true about him, then he no longer exists as God. And God ain't about to let you do that to his character. God should not and cannot become the blame because it goes against his very nature. He is the sum of all things beautiful, the sum of all things holy, pure, and good. For him to tempt anyone means that there's an evil in him, and therefore he cannot be wholly good if there's evil in him. But the Bible teaches that from him flows all good things, every good and perfect gift, and thus an enticement from sin does not come from him. God tests his people, one commentator says, but he never tempts them to sin. If we go back to last week, he tests us to do a work in us, to build us up. Sin is not about building us up. Sin is about tearing us down and pulling us away from God. God allows trials in your life so that he can break down the stuff in your life that doesn't need there and build you up. He says, when you go through trials, don't fight against it, but let it do its work. Because as you endure, as you trust, I am making you as someone better than who you were before. So while God tests, he does not tempt, because the end of temptation, the end of sin is not good, but it's very, very bad. When the Bible speaks of, you can say, well, you know, it says God hardened his heart, or God blinded them, or God, when you read the Bible on a surface level, it could seem that God kind of is the author of temptation, that he causes people to sin. But when the Bible speaks of this, that people have given over to a reprobate mind, that God gives them over to their own lust and desires, and he delivers them over to the devil, to their filthy, shameful actions, it doesn't speak as God as the originator of that blindness, or the originator of the hardness of their heart, but it says that he allows them to continue in their demise. He says he allows them to continue walking down that road that they're walking. He doesn't create fresh evil in people's hearts. He allows people to be as evil as they are and does not intervene and stop the evilness from happening. So when in Exodus he says, when he goes and Moses tells Pharaoh, let my people go. And it says, Pharaoh says, okay. But then he hardens his heart. And it says, God hardens his heart. It's not that God puts that in Pharaoh's heart. It's already in Pharaoh's heart. And God allows Pharaoh to do what he ultimately wants to do. But even in the midst of that, as we know the end of the story, God is still even in control over Pharaoh. So we can't blame God. We should never fix our mouths to say, God made me this way, so I'm just going to do it. If this is the way God made me, we should never give in and be so resigned to sin and to get comfortable in our sin because we believe this error about God's character, that God made me this way. It's not God, baby, it's you. It's me. It's our own evil desires that are pulling us away from God. And even those things that are not inherently evil, that are like neutral things, that are like good things, like when they're used in their proper boundaries and they're used and they're put in their proper place, those things like sex, those things that are not in and of themselves bad, but we take it and we run with it. And we use it outside of God's prescribed boundaries and the purposes that God created it for. And those things become idols for us. Those things become the thing that we can't live without. Those things that we dedicate our time to giving into and dedicating all of our focus and our attention. Those things get elevated from good things to God things. And that's when it becomes a problem. And the evil desires and the lusts in our heart take over. And God is saying that's when you need to identify and step up that there is a problem going on in my heart. It's not my mother, not my brother, but it's me, oh Lord. I'm the one in need of help. He says, he gives this imagery of like fishing and hunting. He says, verse 14, but each one, when he is dragged away and enticed, he's dragged away and enticed by his own evil desires. He gives in to temptation. It's this fishing imagery. And you might say, well, those words should be back there. Isn't it enticement? Then you're dragged away. He says, no, think about it. If you've ever been fishing or if you've ever been hunting, what you want is you want to find the one that has strayed away already. The one that has separated itself from the pack, the one that has isolated himself, that's the one you want. So then you can entice him. Because in a group, it's hard to entice when everyone's going the same direction, when everyone's going the same way, they're focused, they're single-minded, but that one that strays, that one for some reason turns and goes a different direction, that's the one you want to entice. And so just as a fish, if it's swimming with a school of fish, and if for some reason it starts to veer off and it sees something, And that it attracts them. And he said, oh, it's food. Oh, I want this. And after they've been dragged away from the pack, after they have been thrown off course, then they are enticed by that thing. And they say, it's food. And it looks good. I like food. I need food. Even though I just ate, I want more food. But what they don't realize is that at the end of that food is a hook. And he says, each one of us, we are so prone to be led astray. Our hearts wander on their own. You ever realize how, you ever been driving on the freeway and you just kind of just zone out, and then you like wind up in your driveway. You're like, I don't even remember getting off the freeway. I don't even remember. That's how it is. Life comes at you so fast that sometimes you don't even realize that you've wandered off. James has said, you got to take precaution. We should be so singular focused that we should keep our eyes so fixed on Jesus that we don't wander off. We don't veer off, because the minute we take our eyes off Jesus is the minute we start to drift. And when we drift, oh, we're ripe for enticement, because our heart starts to look for something else. Because there's a hole there, because we've taken our eyes off Jesus, the one who fills that hole, and we want. And we got to have, and we need. And he says, each one of us, when our hearts wander, we're enticed by something. And that something always leads to death. How we view temptation speaks volumes of our theology and reveals how we view ourselves. If we look to everything and everyone else as a problem, we keep ourselves from experiencing true freedom and grace that God gives us. It's not everybody else, it's you. In order to overcome, fight temptation, you have to take responsibility for it. You're the cause. And hey, this isn't to make you feel bad, like, dang, I'm struggling. Like, listen, there's a 100% chance that all of us are feeling the same way right now. All of us sin, and all of us have to take responsibility for that sin. If we want to walk in freedom, if we want to experience the victory that God has given us, we got to acknowledge that we're the problem. Number two, remember where the road of sin leads. Remember, unlike fish, who can't picture what's getting ready to happen when they take that bait, God has given us the mental faculty to consider and to weigh the options of, where is this getting ready to take me? I know this thing is good. I know it's going to make me feel good. I know I'll probably calm down if I do it. I know I'll probably settle down if I just give in to it. But God has given us a mental capability and the mental faculties to at least acknowledge where this is going to lead us. And James says this. He goes through the whole process. He says, each person is tempted when by his own evil desire he is dragged away and enticed. Then, after desire has conceived, after it's given birth, after we've allowed that desire to just sit there and marinate and grow, then that's when sin is produced. And when sin, and when desire gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is fully grown, it leads to death. He says, remember where not trusting God gets you. Remember what happens when you go down this road. Remember what it feels like to hit rock bottom. Remember what it feels like to be far from God. Remember what it feels like to not experience the joy and peace that comes from trusting Jesus. Remember how bad, remember the end of destruction that you felt. Remember how it used to feel when you didn't know the peace of God. He says, I know it looks good. I know it feels good. It'll probably make you feel better if you do it in the moment, but it always ends up in death. It's a dead end. James is real upfront in this letter. This ain't one of them fluffy letters that James writes. He wants to get right in it. Stop giving into it because you know where it's going to. Nothing good is going to come from this. And we know it. Oh, God, we know it. But we try to hedge our bets anyway. We try to make that gamble. Like, if I take one hit, it's just one. It's just one time. It's just one drink. It's just one time to cheat on my spouse. It's just one time to cheat on my taxes. It's just one time to cut corners on my job. It's just one time. It's okay. I can control it. I got it. I'm strong. And back then, I was weak. But y'all looking at a new person now. I'm better than that. I'm smarter than that now. I got this. And the longer we allow desire to hang around, it gives birth to sin, and sin leads us to death. Sin always takes you farther than you ever wanted to go and drags you deeper than you ever wanted to go. James is saying, be smart. Don't do it. Trust God. He's way better. He's way better. You know where this story, you know how this story ends. So why not allow God to rewrite your story? Yesterday on the way back from Mexicali, Ted and I and Jose, we had an opportunity to like just share our testimony and be like completely honest about all of our mess. And we just, at the end, we just looked back and was like, thank God that's not who we are anymore. Just a sense of relief of like, man, that was crazy. And then praising God that it could have been worse. Like, it was really bad, but even there's grace in that it could have been worse. And how we're so thankful that we're not there anymore. And how what one of the things that keeps us from going back is because we remember what it feels like to feel like crap. We remember those dark days being apart from God and how hard it was to live life and how hard it was to experience peace and how hard it was to experience joy. And we don't want that anymore now that we've tasted and seen that the Lord is good. That's why David in the psalmist says, taste him. Just give him a taste. You've already tasted what that other stuff feels like. And you're always looking for something. It's never enough. He says, come to the one who's more. Thank you, Jesus. Who's more than enough for you. Trust him. Though sin feels good and it provides pleasure, it puts up this roadblock from us and it keeps us from seeing and savoring and treasuring Christ. Every time you sin, it makes it harder and harder for you to see Jesus. I love A.W. Tozer, how he defines faith. He defines faith as the gaze of the soul, this intent look upon a saving God. He says faith is just continually looking at Jesus. It's Peter. You could have walked the whole Atlantic Ocean if you kept your eyes on Jesus. But the minute you took your eyes off Jesus, you didn't just fall. You begin to drown. Because you want your life to go different. You want to expect. And I want to believe that all of us really want to walk in the victory and joy and peace and power of God. If that's true, keep your eyes on Jesus. Do everything you can to keep your eyes on Jesus. That means you may have to let go of some relationships. That means you need to let go of some hobbies and some things. And it doesn't mean just abstaining from things, but it means actively doing other things, replacing it with other things that will keep your eyes fixed on God. Because if you just stop doing stuff and you just sit at home, your mind doesn't stop wanting those things and desiring those things. Your heart isn't settled just by not doing those things. Your heart is only settled when it's filled with the goodness of Christ. So it's not just stop doing bad things, but it's allow yourself to be put in situations where you are, where Jesus is constantly being put in front of you, where you can see him and treasure him in all of his goodness, in all of his beauty, in all of his grace, so that you can be transformed by his power. You can be experiencing his presence. And it doesn't mean that you got to come to this building every single day. But as you're at work, and maybe you just need background music like I do to be motivated to work, put on something else that'll point you towards Jesus. Turn off the TV. Open up your word. Go spend time with other believers. Do whatever you have to do, whatever you need to do. This is how crucial it is. Choose life. All of us, we're presented. When we're presented with temptation and the temptation to sin, we're given two choices, death or life. That's it. There's no middle ground. You sin and it's going to lead to something very, very bad. Or you choose God and experience abundant life. What you gonna choose? What do you want? I know you don't want to keep struggling with that. I know you don't want to keep fighting with that. I know it sucks to have to keep getting back up and starting over again. Because each time it gets harder and harder. So much so that it's just easier to just give in. But James is saying, when you take responsibility for it, remember where it leads. It leads to destruction and death. It's nothing but trouble. So remember where the road of sin leads. And then lastly, believe the truth about God's goodness. Verse 16, he says, don't be deceived. Don't deceive yourself. Don't allow anybody else to deceive you. Don't be deceived, my dear brothers. Every good and perfect gift comes from God. So you need to be asking yourself, who is this from? What is this from? This thing that I'm presented with that is enticing me, who is this from? If it's enticing you to sin, it ain't from God. This is every good and perfect good, that which is good for you, not just temporarily, but in the long run, that comes from God. God doesn't give you anything that is not good for you or does not bring him glory. Everything God does for us is for our good and for his glory. Ask yourself, when facing temptation, confronting temptation, who is this from? What? Who gets benefit out of this ultimately? In the long run, not just in the moment. But can God be pleased? Will God be pleased after you give in? And if not, it's not from God. Every good and perfect gift comes from God because he is the only one who is good and perfect. This is what James says. He says, correct your theology about God. Fighting temptation, fighting sin is more about how we view God than anything else. You can try as hard as you can, but if you don't change the way you think about God, you'll never overcome temptation. If God is not the ultimate source of good, you're going to keep searching in other places. You're going to keep looking to other people. God must be the one-stop shop for your life. He's all I need. We sang it this morning. All I need is you. And if it ain't you, I don't want it. Even though I kind of want it. I choose to not to engage in it. I choose to not receive it. I choose to not go that route because it's not from you. I know that even the trials, so I'd rather go through a trial, James is saying. Be ready to go through a trial, to suffer, because at least you know God is doing something in that. But in sin, God is allowing you to be separated from him. He's removing his grace and his power and his joy from you. It's better to suffer than to sin. Right? That's crazy. It's better to suffer, carry your own cross, than to sin. God is not the author of temptation, but he allows it. James wants us to correct those errors by proclaiming and exalting the truth about God and his goodness. We need to believe the truth about God's goodness. Last week we learned that as we put our faith in God and as we trust him, especially in trials, the result is experiencing all that God has for us because we know he is active in our lives and that he has committed himself to give us everything we need. And James doubles down on that idea in verse 17 by restating and affirming that what God gives is perfect and sufficient for us. You know what this says to me? God cares about me more than I care about me. Do you see? Do you get the comparison? He's saying, when you conceive evil desires, it leads to death. But when God gives you every good and perfect gift, it produces life. Says that God cares about us more than we care about us. We need to trust the one who ultimately cares. Because if we cared about ourselves, we wouldn't allow ourselves to go down these rabbit trails that end in death. All my desires lead me down the road of destruction, but what God desires for me, which means we don't follow your heart. The heart is deceitful and wicked above all things. Don't follow your heart. Because your heart, apart from God, not trusting God, not seeing and savoring Christ, is going to lead you into destruction. Trust God over your heart. He speaks of that God cares about us more than care about ourselves. He also inserts the consistency of God. God is faithful. God is unchanging. He is we can trust him because he is the same yesterday, today, and forever. But our hearts? How many people you thought you'd been in love with? How many people you thought was the one? How many jobs you thought this is going to be the last job? Oh, this is the perfect one. How many things, if I get this one, just one more, then I'm good. Our hearts are so fickle. One day we're up, one day we're down. One day we want everything, one day we don't want to be bothered with nothing. But he says God is the one who never changed. Our shadows change. Even as we look at creation, if you've ever been to a park and a picnic and you've been sitting in the sun, you know, a couple hours later, the sun is moving. All of a sudden, you're sitting in the shade and you haven't moved, but the shadow and the sun has moved. The heavenly bodies have moved. He says, but God is a constant sun that shines, that gives you everything you need. He is consistent. He is faithful. Trust and rest in his faithfulness. Though the things of this world change, the circumstances of this life change, he never changes. Paul writes that no temptation has overtaken us except what is common to everyone. And God is faithful in the temptation, to get you through the temptation, to give you a way out of temptation, when all that's inside of us wants us to fall into and give into the temptation. Therefore, our safety doesn't lie in trusting ourselves. Our safety lies in trusting in our unchanging God. Hallelujah. Then it brings up the power of the gospel. He says, and I'm done, he chose to give us birth. He says, you want to really see how good God is? He chose to save you. Verse 18, last verse. He chose to give us birth through the word of truth. That is the gospel. That we might be a kind of first fruits of all that he created. The goodness of God and his love is clearly and decisively demonstrated in our salvation. He chose according to his own will, not what we decided to do, not what we wanted to do. He chose according to his own will to come and make us alive in him. To give us a new nature. To give us the power to overcome. By sending Jesus to dwell and live among us and give us life through his death. Freely, we have been given the choicest and greatest gift as being adopted as sons and daughters by our good Father through the life and atonement of Jesus. Through the